Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Human Service Finance Policy and Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, we wanted to begin with the approval of the minutes. Representative Frederick, did you get a chance to review it and move the adoption of the minutes?
Yes, I have, and so moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick moves the approval of the minutes for April 8, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are now adopted for April 8, 2025. Members and the public, today we have a full agenda. This is, there'll be a nonpartisan staff explaining the DE and also the spreadsheet. And we also have 45 individuals who want to testify on the bill. And even more, I think we have a lot of folks who wanted to testify on this bill, but we will have to be out of here by 10:30 latest. With that, I just wanted to welcome Chair Schumacher so that he can move the bill and give a brief statement on the bill today that we'll be having conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will move the DE-1 amendment to be before the committee here. And just to say, as we were thinking about this, the Ways and Means Committee got 3 weeks to set targets. We got 6 days to put an entire budget together. We were given an historic cut to also deal with in this area. And if it weren't for the leadership of Chair Knorr being so reasonable and understanding with what we had in front of us, and also reminding me and others time and time again that this is phase one in an exercise to get to a final budget, we would be in a different spot today. I think that this is one area where we're not going to be happy with what we have in front of us exactly, but we're in a direction that we need to be going. This is not the course. When we have our final markup tomorrow and the final vote, this is not the course that we'll be on, but this is the direction that we'll be taking, and I just wanted to note that as kind of the opening to 2 days of this discussion. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. With that, the DE amendment for House File 2434 is before us. And members, today is just a walkthrough. Tomorrow we'll be taking maybe further amendments to the DE, and we'll have a conversation. So we'll begin with the nonpartisan stuff. I don't know if Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll point you, members should have in their packet a spreadsheet, lower right corner. It is dated 4/7/25 at 3:46 p.m. That's the current official version. And on page one, I'll only note on line seven under the House biennial columns, a negative 300
million. Mr. Burke,
million.
Just wanted to give the members the time to pull the spreadsheet. And you do have a long rule that you can use just to follow through the lines. So you're wondering, why do you have a rule? So.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members. Again, on page one, if you look at line seven, you'll see under the House biennial columns a negative $300 million in 26-27 and a negative $1 billion in 28-29. That is the change from base that this bill makes. If you go down to line 10, you'll see the committee's target, and below that a zero. That is the difference between this bill spending and the target. Moving on, I'll skip over the summary information on the rest of that page and move to page 2, line 133, which is where the Department of Human Services starts. On line 176, we have the governor's operating adjustment. On line 196, we have the governor's maintaining funding to end HIV item. On line 200, we have the sustainable funding for accessing federal data sources recommendation. Moving on to page 3 on line 222 is a program integrity infrastructure item. Moving to the bottom of that page on line 245 is the recommendation on substance use disorder treatment service changes. Moving on to page 4 at the top of the page on line 254 is a recommendation on improving supportive housing options. On line 275 is a no-cost recommendation on Medicaid disability determinations, which is also in the draft. On line 314 and below, this is where the governor's nursing facility payment system changes items come in. You'll see we, on line 318, are taking the phase-in of the new PDPM classification system, but not the rest of the governor's recommendations. On the top of page 5, is on line 357, is the investments in CFSS recommendations. That is at the same level as the governor's recommendation. On line 388 is another no-cost item relative to tribal-specific vulnerable adult and DD targeted case management, which is in, again, no cost. On line 390 is the portion of the governor's request for the Nursing Home Standards Board rules. It does not include the governor's interactivity lines, the last two lines, but the funding for the rules is in there at the governor's level. On the bottom of that page, on line 398, is the start of the governor's DWRS items, the rate exceptions and input monitoring changes are there. And moving on to page 6, I should note that the rate exceptions piece includes the governor's program integrity recommendation. Then going down to line 430 on the governor's recommendations on day and unit-based services. Again, there are only portions of this that are taken in this bill. On line 436, there are training limits, IHS training limits, which are different than the governor's recommendation. This sets an 8-hour a day benchmark. And then at the bottom of that page on line 443 is the IHS training limits night supervision recommendation. Other parts of that recommendation are not in the bill. Moving on to page 7, on line 455, there is an item to eliminate housing support special rates. On line 460 is a governor's recommendation to cancel a grant. Line 468 is the governor's recommendation on behavioral health fund reforms that is the same in the DE1. And then on line 478 is a governor's recommendation on background studies federal compliance, which is at the same level as governor's rec. On line 482 is a no-cost item transitions to direct payments to tribal nations and counties, which is included. And then on line 484 is, and on to the top of page 8, is the governor's budget-neutral technical changes. These just move money around from one budget activity to another to realign the DHS budget after the various changes that have happened in the last year of moving all of a large part out for DCYF and in addition to DCT. This makes a series of strictly technical changes to their budget which have no cost in and of themselves. And I'll pass it over to Mr. Harney.
Chair Knorr, members of the committee, for the rest of the spreadsheet for the Department of Human Services, the balance, with the exception of some program integrity provisions, are related to House files heard by this committee this session. Beginning on line 504, House file 728, Children's Home Respite Care Modifications. On line 509, House file 1166, Disability Services Technology and Advocacy Grant. Line 515, House File 702, Nursing Facility Property Rate Increase. line 520, select portions of House File 671 for SchoolLink Behavioral Health Grants, a work group, and targeted case management. On line 531, included in the House position is one-time spending for the Clay County PRTF, House File 1380. On line 536, House File 2722 for positive support competency training. On line 542 is a no-cost item included in the House position, including nursing and the waiver reimagine work. Turning to page 9, line 550, select sections of House File 1419 are included related to nursing facility payment rates. On line 558, House File 2406, one-time cost for Min Choices systems adjustments. On line 562, House File 1579 is an item related to the tribal encounter rate for housing stabilization. Line 556, House File 1831, are costs tracked one time for background studies reporting on shelter and supportive housing. Line 570, House File 973, is a item related to the mobile crisis vehicles heard before the committee, including a cancellation of mobile crisis grants and a reappropriation in fiscal year 26 of the balance. Line 575 is item related to House File 2060, a one-time cost tracked for supported decision-making programs. Line 581 and lines 5 includes lines 583, 84, and 85 are select cancellations in fiscal years 25 through 26. Turning to page 10 of 14, at the top, lines 587 and 589 are no-cost grant extensions for House Files 2935 and House File 1678. Line 591 is a one-time cost to track for housing support supplemental rate bumps. Line 595 is a provision related to House File 2212 for senior nutrition programs. Line 602 is House File 1674, our one-time cost appropriated for dementia grants. Line 606, House File 2707, is additional funding at the Department of Human Services for additional safe harbor grants. Line 610, House File 2068, is additional ongoing funding for at the Department of Human Services for Homeless Youth Act grants. Line 614, another provision related to House File 2068, are one-time costs for shelter capital. Line 618, the last item related to House File 2068 is a one-time additional funding for the Emergency Services Program. Line 622 is for a grant to the Wilder Foundation for a Homelessness Study. Line 626, House File 1994, includes provisions for a SUD rate increase. Line 635, House File 2187, represents no-cost item for the CARE Carleton grant extension. Turning to page 11, these at the top is line 637, an item related to House File 1894 is the extension of a flat rate for FRS to 1128. Line 645, 651, and 664 reflect the cost tracked earlier on the governor's columns that are just shown here on the House columns for EIDBI provisional licensure, program integrity, and the balance of the governor's request for detecting, preventing, and addressing waste, fraud, and abuse at the Department of Human Services. Line 677 is a House position on additional program integrity and licensing fee changes. Turning to page 12, line 693 is the House position on DWRS inflation adjustment, which is to chain it to CPIU with the 4% annual cap. This provision also tracks the interactive effects within DWRS related to this and other provisions. Line 701 is a nursing facility surcharge. Line 707 reflects costs tracked for the delay of waiver reimagined to 1128, with systems active by 7127 and the implementation of task force changes. Line 713 is a provision related to CAD EBI nursing level of care. Line 718 removes the absence and utilization factor from FRS, CRS, and ICS. Line 723 reflects savings due to the county share of rate exceptions. I'll just note for the committee here that under this proposal, the county will pay 16.28% of the total rate after the federal share is accounted for. Turning from page 12 to page 13 is a item related to the House position tracking costs for behavioral health medical assistance navigators. And lastly, at the Department of Human Services on line 766 is the governor's position on reinstating parental fees for TEFRA above 675% of the federal poverty level. The DCT items in House File 2434 DE1 begin on line 1376. The House position carries the balance of the operating adjustment requested by the governor. On line 1385, the House position carries the tails cost for the inpatient competency attainment examination liability and data sharing governor's request. Line 1389, House File 2586, is DNMC funding for priority admissions. Line 1393, House File 2187, is funding for DCT electronic health record system and IT projects. Line 1397, House File 670, shows one-time cost for the DCT locked PRTF work group. Line 1420, bleeding over to the next page, reflects in the House position carrying the tails portion of the governor's request to increase the county share of care, increase the county cost of care for MSOP. And lastly, Chair Knorr, we have the Department of Health on line 1498 includes funding related to House File 2707 for additional funding for the Safe Harbor Program at MDH. And lastly, lines 1735 and 1739 include the governor's recommendation for the operating adjustments at the Council on Disability and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, that concludes the walkthrough of the spreadsheet.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bragg and Mr. Haney, for your presentation. I know we could not have done this work without your help, so I just wanted to say thank you. I wanted to express that on behalf of the whole committee, so thank you. Do we have any technical questions on the spreadsheet? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. On page 10, line 635, it says Care Carlton grant extensions. The language in the bill is Care St. Peter, and so the intention is Care St. Peter. I just wanted to put that out there for the public record that there's a typo in the spreadsheet. Thank you.
The typo is noted as we deliberate the process, so we'll be making those changes going forward. So anyone else who has got a technical question on the spreadsheet? Seeing none, I think now we move to the discussion on the DE by the nonpartisan staff. We have Ms. Munier.
Mr. Chair, members, Ms. Sunderman and I are going to be working off of a document that's a list of bills that are included in the DE. It should be in everybody's packet. Looks like this.
Members, you have the DE1. In your packet that explains the changes in the DE. So if you can pull out and follow along, please.
Mr. Chair, members, the first article starting on page 1 of the DE is the Aging Services article. Sections 1 and 12 are a new proposal that increase the nursing home license surcharge fee and the corresponding portion of the nursing facility external fixed cost payment rate related to the surcharge. Sections 2, 3, 16, and 17 are from House File 1678. This modifies essential community supports eligibility criteria and extends the availability of the Caregiver Respite Services grant appropriation from fiscal year 2025, or for fiscal year 2025, I should say. Section 4 is from House File 702. This extends the expiration date for certain time-limited nursing facility property rate increases. Sections 5, 6, and 19, or 9 through 13, add an inflationary factor to the nursing facility payment rate system and a temporary rate adjustment for nursing home wage standards established by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. Sections 7, 8, and 14 are from the governor's budget proposal. provides for the transition from the RUG-4 case mix classification system to the new PDPM case mix classification system for nursing facilities. And Section 15 in aging services is also a governor's budget proposal. Beginning January 1 of 2028, it provides for a nursing facility rate add-on for workforce standards established by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. If there aren't any questions on Article 1, I can move to Article 2, Disability Services, which starts on page 16 of the DE document. Sections 1 through 3 and 15 are a new proposal. This modifies the nursing facility level of care criteria for the BI and CADI waiver eligibility. Sections 4, 11, 32 through 36, 50, and 51 are a governor's budget proposal providing for investments in community first services and supports and consumer directed community supports to fund the labor agreement between the state of Minnesota and SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa for individual providers of direct support services. Sections 5, 6, 17 through 19, 37, and 38 are a governor's budget proposal providing for provisional licensure of EIDBI providers. Sections 7, 8, and 48 modify positive support professional and positive support analyst required qualifications. Section 9 exempts settings that meet certain criteria from licensure when providing out-of-home respite care services for children. Section 10 establishes a disability services technology and advocacy expansion grant. Sections 12, 13, and 14 authorize abbreviated annual reassessments for people receiving disability waiver services. Section 16 is a governor's budget proposal that includes tribes as an allowable provider of targeted case management services for vulnerable adults and persons with developmental disabilities. Section 20 is a new proposal. It requires a county share of the cost of services for all individual waiver recipients who receive a rate exception under the DWRS rate system. Sections 21, 23, and 29 are a governor's budget proposal establishing different rates under DWRS for awake night supervision and asleep night supervision. Sections 22 and 24 are new. They modify future DWRS inflationary adjustments. Sections 25, 26, and 27 are new. They remove the absence and utilization factor that is used in DWRS rate calculations for three different services: community residential services, family residential services, and integrated community supports. Section 28 is a governor's budget proposal. It limits billing for individualized home supports with training and individualized home supports with family training to 8 hours per day. Section 30 is a governor's budget proposal. It limits rate exceptions for residential services under WRS. Section 31 is a governor's budget proposal. It subjects DWRS payments to MA sanctions and monetary recovery requirements. Sections 39, 40, 49, and 52 is a new proposal. This delays the implementation of Waiver Reimagine Phase 2, requires the commissioner to develop an individualized budget methodology exception to support access to home care nursing services under the disability waivers, expands topics to be included in a Waiver Reimagine report to the legislature, establishes an advisory task force on Waiver Reimagine, and it repeals the Waiver Reimagine Advisory Committee. Sections 41 through 45 and 47 delay the implementation of family residential services and life sharing services new rate implementation. And section 46 in Article 2 delays the supported decision-making grants report to the legislature by 2 years. And that concludes Article 2. The next article is Article 3, healthcare, which begins on page 74 of the DE. Sections 1 through 14 and 16 are a governor's budget proposal that reinstates TEFRA parental fees for parents with income equal to or greater than 675% of the federal poverty guidelines. And section 15 is a governor's no-cost budget proposal that enhances Medicaid disability determinations. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Sunderman for Article 4.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 4 is the behavioral health article. It starts on page 81 of the bill, or of the DE. Sections 1 through 3 are from the governor's budget bill. These are adult mental health initiative funding utilization and administration changes. Section 4 from House File 2115, first engrossment from Representative Schumacher. This expands the definition of child in the Children's Mental Health Act to include a person ages 18 to 21 receiving continuous children's mental health targeted case management services. Next, we have sections 5, 27, 44 through 50, and 54 through 56. These are an amended version of the governor's proposal to change sober homes to recovery residences, and the sections also establish requirements and certification for recovery residences and a work group. Next, we have sections 6 through 13, 15 through 24, 26, 36, 43, 52, 53, and 59. These are all from the governor's bill as amended. These are the substance use disorder treatment program and service changes and provider qualification changes, and there are also several sections that make technical cross-reference changes. Sections 14 and 57 are a new proposal. This is the substance use disorder care coordination and navigator services, and it also includes an evaluation and recommendations from the commissioner. Sections 25, 28 through 35, 37, 41, and 42 are all from the governor's bill as amended. These are the behavioral health fund payment reforms, and they also, so they limit behavioral health fund eligibility to 60 consecutive days per year. They modify the county share, and they prohibit new standalone room and board services vendors from receiving behavioral health fund payments. Sections 38 and 39 are from House File 1994, a modified version from Representative Frederick. These sections adjust substance use disorder treatment service rates based on the recent rate study and add annual inflation for those rates. Sections 36 and 40 are a new proposal requiring compliance training for recovery community organization owners who are active in management and for managers and supervisors. Section 51 is from the governor's budget bill. This section requires direct payments to tribal nations and urban Indian communities for traditional healing practices and culturally specific providers rather than grants. Section 58 is from House File 671, not 617, as in the bill list. This is from Representative Hicks. This establishes the PRTF work group. And Section 60 from the governor's budget bill repeals statutes related to substance use disorder treatment, sober homes, and the behavioral health fund. And that concludes the behavioral health article. Moving to Article 5, this is on page 138 of the DE. This is the background studies article. Sections 1 through 3, 9, 17 through 19 are from the governor's budget bill. These are technical and clarifying changes. Sections 4 through 6 and Section 8 are also from the governor's budget bill. These sections specify that background studies are required for owners, operators, employees, or volunteers providing direct contact, home and community-based services, housing stabilization, and EIDBI services. Section 7, also from the governor's budget bill, contains technical changes and also requires unlicensed HCBS housing stabilization and housing stabilization providers to initiate background studies before enrollment under specified circumstances. The remaining sections are all from the governor's budget bill. Section 10 sets fees for child foster care and adoption background studies. Section 11 establishes background study requirements for EIDBI providers. Sections 12 and 13 establish disqualifications for violations of statutes related to human services program exclusion and sanctions. Sections 14 and 15 add the crime of child torture to the permanent disqualifications. And Section 16 requires the commissioner to give preeminent weight to program integrity in addition to safety when reviewing background study reconsideration requests. And that concludes Article 5. Moving to Article 6, and this is the Department of Human Services Program Integrity Article. This starts on page 152. Sections 1 through 4, 6, 9, 10, 16, 18, and 19 are all from the governor's budget bill. These are program integrity and fraud prevention provisions related to investigative data and data exchanges, withholding of payments for fraud or theft convictions, pending investigations and actions, and background study documentation. Sections 5 and 6 are new. These sections allow the commissioner to issue a discretionary temporary licensing moratorium for up to 24 months, and then they outline the requirements for issuing such a moratorium and make a related technical change. Section 8 is also a new proposal. This allows the commissioner to review all new license holders within 12 months after a change in ownership. Sections 11 through 14, this is also a new proposal. These sections increase DHS licensing fees and add fees for satellite facilities, and then also deposit the fee amounts into an account for program integrity activities in addition to licensing. Section 15 is from the governor's budget bill. This section prohibits duplicative claim submission for behavioral health funds, substance use disorder treatment services. Sections 17 and 20 are also from the governor's budget bill. For MA enrollment, these sections require that actions to obtain monetary recovery or sanctions from a surety bond occur within 6 years from the date the debt is affirmed by a final agency decision. And that concludes Article 6. Moving to Article 7, Direct Care and Treatment, this article starts on page 182 of the DE. Sections 1 and 2 are from a modified version of House File 2586 from Representative Frederick. These sections extend the expiration of the exceptions for Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and Community Behavioral Health Hospital county shares of the cost of care, and it extends the expiration until July 1, 2027. Section 3 is from the governor's budget bill. This increases the county responsibility for cost of care for individuals in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, effective July 1, 2027. Section 4 is from House File 2817, as amended, from Representative Frederick. This requires $5 million of general fund cost of care collections to be deposited into the DCT systems account to support the electronic health record system and IT projects at DCT. And sections 5 through 11 are also from the governor's budget bill. These are the provisions related to inpatient examination and competency attainment programs, and related to the county of financial responsibility, costs, information, and data access. And that concludes Article 7. And Ms. Pinelli will go through Article 8.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 8 is the Homelessness, Housing, and Support Services article. It begins on page 190 of the DE document. Sections 1 and 2 are new. They expand requirements for enrollment as a housing stabilization services provider to include completion of compliance training before applying for enrollment and every 3 years thereafter. Section 3 modifies the MSA equivalent rate adjustment under the chapter of statutes governing housing supports. Section 4 establishes emergency shelter facility grants to improve or expand emergency shelter facility operations. Section 5 is new. It requires the Commissioner of Human Services to conduct an evaluation of housing support background study requirements and report back to the legislature with findings by December 1st of 2027. And Sections 6 and 8 are new. They require the Commissioner of Human Services to temporarily increase housing support supplementary services rates in fiscal years 26 and 27 and repeal special housing support supplementary service rates for specific housing support providers. And Section 7 of Article 8 requires the commissioner to seek federal approval to authorize MA Housing Services reimbursement for services provided by Indian Health Services and facilities owned and operated by a tribe or tribal organization. And that concludes Article 8. Article 9 is the miscellaneous article. It begins on page 195 of the DE document. Section 1 is a governor's budget proposal, makes a conforming change to MnChoice's assessment timelines. And Section 2 is also a governor's budget proposal. It authorizes DHS to draw down federal match for reentry waiver capacity building and implementation grants. And that concludes all of the language articles in the DE.
Thank you so much to Ms. Pugnelli and also Ms. Sunderman for the thorough process. We always appreciate the work the nonpartisan House Research do for all of us. Just wanted to note, members, we will have more discussion tomorrow. So today is just to go through the public discussion, but also if you have any technical question regarding the articles that we just covered in the DE 1. I also wanted to clarify, I know we have the sections on the supplemental housing support. The intent is not to eliminate the supplemental housing support. I've had so many questions. This is specific areas where there's specific legislation that we have put in the system that there's a special rate added on. So clarifying, we're not eliminating supplemental housing support. Our intent will be made clear if we can put an amendment on it. With that, members, we move to public discussion. The first person on the list is Commissioner Gandhi, followed by CEO Marshall Smith. So we will get started. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and members of the House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm serving as the temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for your collaborative leadership that transcends partisan ideals to improve the quality of health and human services and strengthen program integrity. Developing a budget this session is particularly challenging. And I'm pleased to see that your proposed budget bill includes responsible reforms to address the projected budget shortfall and investments to improve people's lives. Thank you for the inclusion of several of Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's key budget priorities, including making investments to protect, prevent, detect, and address fraud to strengthen the parameters of our system and root out bad actors. Minnesota is committed to Minnesota is committed to helping our neighbors and fraud against public programs harms the very people we're trying to help. Recommitting to Minnesota's comprehensive long-term plan to end new HIV infections and improve health outcomes for people living with HIV. In 2023, 56% of new diagnoses were in greater Minnesota and suburban communities. This investment acts as a stopgap measure to prevent further funding reductions. bolstering oversight of recovery residences and expanding access to supportive recovery housing options. This proposal aligns oversight with national best practices and ensures recovery residences have access to ongoing funding that is not tied to a person's treatment status. Building on historic investments in the community first services and supports so that people have meaningful options to live and work in their homes. This funding also ensures implementation of the self-directed workforce contract between SEIU, Healthcare Minnesota, and the state. Including funding to implement standards adopted by the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board, good jobs are the foundation of an equitable economy, and the caring community is the backbone of the human services system. Strengthening health and safety protections for children and young adults with autism who use early intensive developmental and behavioral interventions. Prioritizing tribal sovereignty by creating a path for tribal nations to access the federally funded rates for vulnerable adults and developmental disabilities targeted case management. Utilizing data-based and person-centered approaches to address disability waiver spending, including practical limits on billing for training services and distinct reimbursement for asleep and awake services. These approaches shield people and families from blunt tools such as waiver caps and large-scale cuts. Ensuring people who have access to substance use disorder services have access to comprehensive health coverage under Minnesota's Medical Assistance Program. Shifting to new models of SUD treatment that integrate clinical and social supports while also facilitating transparent billing practices. These changes better support accountability, individualized needs, and positive outcomes. Funding the operating adjustment for state-operated safety net programs which offer services for people with mental illness, substance abuse disorders, and developmental and intellectual disabilities. As a highly specialized healthcare system, direct care and treatment cannot operate programs without sufficient staffing to provide safe and effective treatment. Funding the operating adjustment for DHS to ensure mounting cost pressures do not impact services delivered to Minnesotans. And expanding oversight to increase the frequency of provider revalidation visits. This proposal requires revalidation every 3 years instead of every 5 years for high-risk providers. We are excited to see investments to improve Minnesota's substance use disorder continuum of care that reflect DHS's recommendations to implement data-informed reimbursement rates. We're also pleased to see funding for regional projects that expand access to psychiatric residential treatment facility services for children and young adults. And lastly, we are deeply appreciative that the bill includes tribal and county priorities, including the housing stabilization services tribal encounter rate and transitioning to direct payment for adult mental health initiative grants. As this bill makes its way through the legislative process, we hope to continue dialogue about data-driven approaches to fraud detection and prevention using modern technologies such as artificial intelligence, machine learning, and case management. We also look forward to ongoing discussions that would align disability waiver rates with data to ensure long-term sustainability amid rapidly shifting population demographics. In the weeks ahead, our team will continue to analyze the bill and provide feedback and technical assistance to this committee as helpful. Thank you again for your unwavering focus on people, families, and communities who at some point either directly or indirectly benefit from a robust human services system. And Chair, I'd like to turn it over to CEO Marshall Smith to talk about the direct care and treatment aspects.
Well, thank you so much, Commissioner, for the collaboration from the department, including your amazing staff for the work that they do. So thank you so much. CEO Smith. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, members of the Human Service Committee. For the record, I'm Marshall Smith. I serve as the Health System CEO for Direct Care and Treatment. On behalf of DCT and all of our staff, we want to thank you, the committee, for supporting Direct Care and Treatment's operational budget and the critical funding for our electronic health record. The continued funding will provide the necessary staff and technologies for the upcoming biennium. I'd like to personally thank all of you for your discussions this year on behalf of the entire behavioral health system in Minnesota. Your discussions are setting the foundation for Minnesota to build up the desperately needed behavioral health services at all levels. DCT's new vision, a Minnesota where everyone receives the behavioral health services they need, and our mission is we support meaningful lives through specialized behavioral health services others do not provide. With your supporting language, the last few years, starting July 1st of this year, DCT will separate into a new agency focusing on this important work. We look forward to working with you, Chair Noor and Chair Schumacher, on maintaining and building services and programs to support those who need behavioral health services. Representative Vernig and Representative Baker, who will be joining the DCT Advisory Council starting January of 2026. Our continued partnership with Representative Frederick, with his background in forensics and his focus on bonding. Representative Hicks, for her passion in pediatrics and building children's services for behavioral health. And all of you to build a behavioral health model in Minnesota that others will want to replicate. Mr. Chair and members, again, thank you for your continued support for DCT.
Thank you, CEO Smith, and also to your team for the amazing work that they do every day. So with that, we will move to the other members. So I just wanted to make sure that we keep our comments short. So I will ask Brian Zerbis, Commissioner Mojo, and also Bob Dahl to come to the testify table and introduce yourselves and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zerbis. I'm the Executive Director of MARCH, a statewide trade association for substance disorder programs and professionals. First, I want to say thank you for having substance disorder rate increases included in the budget targets. Providers, stakeholders, advocates have been working on this for a very long time, so we're very pleased to see that. In our letter, we noted, obviously, there's lots of benefits to treatment. I won't go into the details here. Going into some of the questions and feedback in the behavioral health section, so one point, Article 4, Section 39 is the section that actually touches on the rate increases, and the language in line 113.16 says for some of the rate increases, it's looking at 72% of the modeled rate. We just want to make sure that the rate are increases, as opposed to taking 72% of the modeled rate, may actually result in some cuts in the group rate, for example. So in that section, we would encourage that the intended rate increase be listed as a number, as opposed to citing a percentage. Moving on into other later parts in that article, section 32 and 34 are related to changes to behavioral health fund eligibility, moving the determination to DHS. Providers have some concerns that taking that out of the counties may result in bottlenecking, which would not be good. Also within that is a limitation of a 60-day eligibility span for people on the behavioral health fund. Again, we have concerns that that may have some unintended consequences with clients getting access. Moving on to section 37 is the elimination of freestanding room and board. This is another area of concern for us in a later section where it talks about the recovery residents work group in section 56. We would look or ask to have that work group look at how freestanding room and board should transition, what the future of the state should look like regarding housing options.
Mr. Service, I hate to cut anybody off today, but I've got a long list of people if you can wrap up.
Perfect. Last, in section 56 on the work group, please add MARCH to that work group. And then lastly, Article 6, Section 13, regarding the license fee increases for mental health and STD programs. It's roughly a four times increase on the rate for the license fee. We would just ask that that increase be contingent on if rates are increased, it would be less of a concern. If rates don't get increased, it would be a huge burden to programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Moy.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, and the members of the committee. I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to be before you today. And as I return, my name is Jenny Mojo, a Clay County Commissioner, and since my last testimony before you, hundreds of children, some as young as 10, have continued to wait for appropriate placement in psychiatric residential treatment facilities, and many will likely wait for months more. These children are not just statistics. They are our neighbors, our students, and our future. The impact of this delay is felt by their families and our communities, and by the children themselves. But we have the power to change this, the opportunity to be part of the solution to ensure that children facing severe mental health challenges are not left to wait for the care that they urgently need. Thank you for your continued support in helping Clay County address this need with the proposed development of the new PRTF in Moorhead. Representative Keeler's House File 1380 would ensure accessibility and provide the space for Minnesota's most vulnerable children to have access to the high acuity care that they need and give children, our children, a chance for healing and hope. Turning to a broader mental health issue, the AMC priority in human services includes addressing a long overdue need for increased capacity in direct care and treatment. If DCT capacity is not adequately addressed in this human services bill, it becomes even more urgent to include Representative Frederick's House File 2587 to expand beds at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Facility. We need to sufficiently fund a robust bonding bill to include long overdue expansion of bed capacity. I'd also like to remind the committee of the Priority Admissions Review Panel agreement, which states no changes to the 48-hour rule should move forward without a corresponding increase in DCT capacity. Furthermore, I must raise concerns about the historic cost shifts to counties, county taxpayers in this bill. These shifts will result in double-digit property tax increases for many counties across our state, simply to absorb the increased costs outlined in this bill. These proposals do not manage costs effectively or slow the growth or expenses. They shift financial burden to our local governments, who are already doing the best we can to triage the needs of our residents. We are grateful for the work that you all do. We are very grateful of it, and we must recognize the tough decisions that you have to make. But AMC strongly urges lawmakers to reject cost shifts to counties. Counties are doing the work with the state, but without the necessary resources and support, these unfunded mandates will have serious consequences for our communities. Thank you for your time, consideration, and your work as we work together for a meaningful difference in the lives of Minnesotans to ensure our communities are supported with the resources they need to deliver essential services. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. We will move to the next testifier. In the meantime, I wanted to make sure Dr. Bostrom, Erin Hubert, and also Kyle Bunt can move close to the testifier table. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Barb Dahl, and I serve as the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County. And I'm also here today representing MACSA and MICA. First, I want to thank the chairs for including our MACSA priority on MnChoices reassessments. The provisions in this bill streamline the MnChoices tool, which county workers navigate daily, making it a top priority for all counties. Allowing for less involved of reassessments for individuals whose situations remain unchanged year after year, expanding the use of technology to conduct reassessments, and permitting verbal attestations from those we serve will significantly improve efficiency. This will also free up county financial workers and help address the enormous backlog for individuals awaiting initial assessment. We have worked towards these solutions for a long time, and we are pleased to see this progress. Counties also appreciate the inclusion of language for a two-year extension of waiving county does not meet criteria billing when the cost is due to lack of DCT capacity, along with a spreadsheet allocating $15 million in one-time funding. However, this funding lacks sustainability beyond this investment. Minnesota counties are billed at 100% for the cost of care when the person no longer meets medical criteria for hospitalization. yet counties are powerless to move individuals to their next bed when the next necessary bed is a state-operated DCT facility bed. These daily costs can be upwards of $2,300 a day. This current two-year reprieve of $10.2 million of these costs is set to end in July. Without a provision extending this or making it permanent, an additional hidden cost to county property taxes would occur. However, this bill does shift $65 million in cost to local property taxes for the 28-29 biennium, stemming from the governor's budget. These shifts include new competency attainment cost, increasing county cost shares for cost of care at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, an increased county share for the Behavioral Health Fund. These cost shifts are imposed despite counties having no lever to control these costs and no longer having a role in the eligibility determinations or comprehensive assessments for the Behavioral Health Fund, leaving local governments powerless to manage these escalating costs. While the Senate eliminates the governor's proposed county cost shift for waiver residential services, this bill introduces a new county cost share for waiver exemption. It is nearly double the cost of the original shift, and this will force local governments to absorb over $379 million in the 28-29 biennium. Counties cannot sustain these property tax shifts without serious consequences to our communities.
Ms. Dahl, if you can please wrap up, because we've got a long list of people waiting.
Absolutely. We urge lawmakers to reject these cost shifts and uphold a fair state-local partnership in human services funding, and we thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Do we have Idil Abdul via Zoom? Not seeing it, Dr. Bostrom. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I'm Dr. Jared Bostrom, Chief Executive Officer at Progress Valley. We're a Minnesota nonprofit that served adults with substance use and mental health disorders since 1972. I'm here to testify in opposition of the provision in this bill, Article 437, to discontinue freestanding room and board and replace with housing supports for a few reasons. One, freestanding room and board and housing supports are both absolutely critical services, but they're very different and serve very different needs. There would be a lot of work to do if this change goes forward to align these levels of care together to meet the needs of people. There's a long list of examples I won't go into, but freestanding room and boards are specifically designed as an extension of substance use treatment programs to have things that support people in early recovery that are not present in housing supports. Availability is also a concern. We know that some of the largest counties are not taking applications for housing supports right now. Even if that's significantly expanded, it will take time for providers to acquire buildings, modify them, get approvals, design services, and have everything going. Second point is that recovery housing is already a challenge today, and that's been exacerbated. If you're not aware, many providers offer housing through various forms of stipends, vouchers, or scholarships. There's been recent discussions about anti-kickback considerations related to such practices. The possibility that they may be discontinued poses significant threats to the stability of the housing supports program that's in place today. Some estimates show this could impact upwards of 3,000 people in Minnesota. So removing an entire level of care at this time, when we're also facing the instability of our current housing system, is a lot at once, and I think would amplify the cost and consequences of not having proper supports. Finally, although this proposal will save some money, I'm confident it will pale in comparison to the cost we will incur if this goes through and we don't have an adequate support system and people end up in higher levels of care and jails and detoxes and et cetera. I'll just say that our experience, we actually saw this because we operate two freestanding room and board facilities. One was open for 7 months before the other had full approvals, and we saw a significant difference
in outcomes. Dr. Wilson, if you can please wrap up, I'll appreciate it.
Yes, sir. In terms of people having substance use, needing higher levels of care, and so on. So in conclusion, our request, as submitted in the March letter, is to fund the Recovery Residence Work Group to evaluate, determine, and fund viable housing options before eliminating the freestanding room and board. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Berndt. I am here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. which represents over 2,000 providers across the senior care continuum. We offer our extreme gratitude to this committee for hearing our concerns about the impact of the unfunded mandates on nursing facilities, including jeopardizing access to care for Minnesota seniors across the state. Nursing home care is an entitlement, and it is clear that House File 2434 protects that benefit for older adults. I will now turn it over to my colleague to finish our testimony.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert, and I am also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We thank the committee for funding the mandates of the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. As this committee understands, the cost of the minimum wage mandate is not reflected in the current Medicaid forecast. Rather, the mandates enacted by the board would require nursing facilities to reallocate existing resources, spend down reserves, or take on debt to cover the costs until they are reflected in BBR rates 18 to 21 months down the road. So the combination of the facility payments as well as the known cost change would correct that oversight for the two rules enacted by the board. Again, thank you very much for your support of older adults and their right to access nursing home care in the community that they choose to call home.
Thank you so much. Next, I have Sarah Grefstrom, Robert Freeman, and Josh Berg. Please come to the testify table, introduce yourself, and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Nora, Chair Schumacher, and members of the Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am here today representing ARM and over 230 disability waiver service providers. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. I want to start by just acknowledging a few of the really good provisions that are in the Human Service Omnibus Bill. We are encouraged to see out-of-home respite, technology grants, and the family residential service rate tier delay included. I would go into detail about all of the important things that those provisions do, but in the interest of time, I'll just say thank you. And while we're grateful for these important proposals, ARM has strong concerns with many of the proposals in the bill that will be incredibly damaging to residential waiver services if implemented. First, removing the absence and utilization factor from CRS, FRS, and ICS services will be devastating for providers and would result in a rate cut of over 4%. The absence and utilization factor is included in the waiver framework to cover the costs incurred by a provider when an individual is gone from the home or there is a bed opening in the home and the provider cannot bill for services. By removing the absence and utilization factor, we are saying that individuals will never be gone from the home and there will never be an opening, which is simply unrealistic. One mid-sized provider shared with me that for their organization alone, this would equate to a $1.5 million loss annually. We are also concerned with the 4% proposed cap on future inflationary adjustments. Rates within the DWRS are adjusted every other year. A 2% annual adjustment is below the rate of inflation and prohibits providers from being able to offer competitive wages. We will not fix this workforce crisis if wages for direct support staff are not made a priority by the state. The bill also proposes many changes to the rate exception process and a county share for rate exceptions. Rate exceptions are established for individuals with exceptional needs, and we have concerns that by implementing the changes proposed and moving toward the 6733 county share, we are removing the person-centeredness that needs to exist when establishing a rate exception, creating winners and losers depending on what county you live in and their ability to fund the exception. Finally, in addition to the cuts being proposed, the bill increases the provider's annual county licensing fee by 320%, an annual department licensing fee by 25%. Adding new fees on top of hundreds of millions of dollars in cuts is simply not sustainable. If someone from the outside were to look at this proposal, the perception could be made that disability waiver services are doing well and can absorb the kind of cuts that are being proposed. The reality could not be farther from the truth. The average wage for DSPs is a little over $17 an hour. We have vacancy rates exceeding 30%, with many providers teetering on the brink of home closures or altogether business closures. The targeted cuts to disability waiver services are disproportionate to the rest of the budget proposal and leaves these incredibly critical services at risk of no longer being sustainable going forward. I'll conclude by saying no one in the House cares more about people with disabilities than the people who sit on this committee. I hope, and our members hope, that as we continue to work toward a final budget solution, these proposals will be reconsidered. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, my name is Robert Freeman. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota North Dakota Chapter. On behalf of the more than 100,000 Minnesotans with Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia, and the 164,000 people who are their unpaid caregivers, I wanted to thank the committee for providing funding for competitive grants to communities across Minnesota to increase awareness of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, promote the benefits of screening for early identification of dementia, increase the rates of cognitive testing in the population at risk, and connect family, friends, neighbors who are caregivers to education, support, and resources. As I mentioned in committee when I testified previously, this funding prioritizes geographic diversity, tribal nations, veterans, and other traditionally underserved populations. In the interest of time, I'll just end there. We're so grateful for the committee's support of Minnesota families impacted by dementia. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, before Josh starts, I just wanted to make sure that Lori Schultenhofer and Dr. Zinder and Darby, if you can come to the testify table, please get ready there. Mr. Breck, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Josh Berg, and I represent a nonprofit based in St. Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to offer brief comments on the Human Services Omnibus Bill as currently drafted. Mr. Chair and members, HF 2434 is a non-starter. The provisions in this bill, along with those omitted, suggest that the budgets being proposed by the House and the Governor are being balanced on the backs of individuals with disabilities and our most vulnerable Minnesotans. This approach is neither fair nor equitable. If the targets set by leadership are contributing to this issue, I urge you to stand up for those of us in here today, and more importantly, those who are not here and not present. The lives of the individuals who depend on these services are at stake. I am here advocating on their behalf, and I believe many others inside and outside this room will support you in righting this wrong. Suggesting that the target set or this bill is a fair approach to balancing the budget is almost laughable, and I expected better from our state's legislative leaders. There are aspects of this bill that make sense and others that I fully support, such as the Disability Services Technology Grant and the flexibility provided with reassessments. Furthermore, while I strongly disagree with the delay of Waiver Reimagine, which I see as a waste of nearly $50 million, the proposed language prohibiting home care nursing for individuals receiving ICS inadvertently highlights, as I and others have been stating for years, the need for nursing services to be reimbursed within the ICS framework. Without this provision, access to essential nursing services will be cut for those who need it most. You will hear from over 30 more individuals and organizations after me expressing concerns and issues with this bill. Like the governor's original proposal, this bill fails to accomplish the mission of this committee and the moral imperative you all deeply embrace. Before I conclude, I want to explain why my testimony took this direction and tone. Initially, I planned to highlight the good, the neutral, and the problematic components of this bill. However, after attending the Distinguished Carlson Lecture with Dr. Anthony Fauci last evening, I rewrote my testimony. Two moments from the lecture motivated me to pivot. The dean introducing Dr. Fauci encouraged the audience to lean in, listen, and learn. I urge you all to do the same today, especially since these comments relate to the omnibus bill that defines the work of this committee. This is your chance to get this right, and there are many brilliant and passionate individuals in this room ready to help. Secondly, Dr. Fauci shared advice from a mentor. Avoid the temptation to say what others want to hear instead of just the cold facts, just to be invited back. Good people will recognize the intention, respect you for it, and invite you back. This is my goal with my testimony today and the way I intend to work with all of you. If you are interested in diving into the details, correcting the significant issues, or finding compromises to reduce spending, I am more than happy to have the conversation with any and all of you. With that, Mr. Chair and members, assuming I am invited back, I look forward to collaborating with you, the departments, the other body, and the governor's office as we navigate the challenging decisions ahead and find workable solutions to an untenable situation. We can do better, and we must do better.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify and speak before you this morning. My name is Lori Schlutenhofer. I am co-president and CEO of Services for Opportunity Partners, a metro area disability service provider that offers supports in residential living, employment, and day services for Minnesotans with disabilities. I also serve on the Board of Directors for MORE, the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, an association of nearly 100 day service and employment providers throughout the state. I want to start my brief testimony by acknowledging, as other testifiers had, the really excruciating, painful work that this committee and the organizations and people in this room have had to be part of. We know that this year is a very challenging situation. I'll start by saying we are very grateful for the work of this committee and the fact that you did not include the governor's recommendation for a clawback of the absence and utilization factor for day services in the omnibus bill. That is something, as we've shared in this committee earlier, that would represent a devastating cut to funding for those providers. I do need to share that we have deep concerns about the proposal that will cap the inflationary adjustments in the disability waiver rate system as far as staff wages, cap those increases at 4%. Which we feel is a very arbitrary rate. After years of advocacy, we were finally on a path to try and get those wages on par with the rest of the community, the non-caregiving workforce. And this is simply going to set us back even further. I know that you've heard and you will hear more stories today from organizations that are looking at difficulties with this. I'll give you a few examples. For organizations like mine, right now we have nearly 300 people who are sitting on a waiting list to access services. Many of them are young adults who are new to the waiver system, graduated from their transition services during the pandemic, and have yet to be able to access services. It impacts Minnesota families in a really deep and meaningful way as these young adults are isolated at home, starting to lose some of the skills they developed during education.
Wrap up, your testimony.
Thank you, sir. I want to acknowledge again that these are very hard decisions, and nobody's going to be unscathed or happy with every decision that we need to make while we're here today. I empathize deeply because as I look at the funding picture for us, I'm going to have similar conversations to the ones that you're having with your constituents as I talk with the families, the staff, and the people that we support in our organization, but we stay at MORE. We stay committed to continuing the partnership. Appreciate that in these difficult times you have included us, and we stand ready to help. Thanks.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman and members, my name is Dr. Lou Zeidner, and I serve as the CEO of EOSIS, formerly known as Meridian Behavioral Health. We represent about 25% of the Medicaid beds in high-intensity residential SUD services in the state. High-intensity residential SUD care is an initial access point for care for patients struggling with drugs and alcohol. Obstacles to recovery for many include getting away from the environment where they use and being able to clear their bodies and minds long enough to begin to make behavioral changes needed to enter long-term recovery. We have seen the bill draft that reflects no increase in 2026 or 2027 for high-intensity residential care. Denying financial sustainability for high-intensity residential programs, even while funding lower-intensity programs, will reduce access for care for thousands of Minnesota residents who need a safe, drug-free environment with intensive levels of treatment and support to initially stop using drugs and alcohol. It's like adding lanes to the highway while restricting the access ramps. As I have previously testified, without a rate increase for high-intensity residential SUD services, we will go out of business before the end of this year. The 8,000 Medicaid and behavioral health fund patients that we treat each year will lose access to the care we provide. Currently, the gap between our cost of providing care and our Medicaid reimbursement is $60 per patient day. We lose $60 for each patient day they are in care. I have heard that there is confusion about the 1115 rates implemented in recent years. Those were not rate increases. They provide incremental payment and at the same time require substantial incremental provider costs to meet the needs of patients with co-occurring psychiatric care. They increase access for complex patients, but they did not relieve the financial burdens of high-intensity residential care. I am used to clinical and business challenges, but I have never before found my organization in this level of desperation. I beg this group to find some monies to help sustain high-intensity residential substance use disorder treatment in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. Dobie, please introduce yourself. Before you begin, I just wanted to make sure Danny Eckert and also Carson Anderson and Maureen Schneider can get ready. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and members of the committee. My name is Starlisha Dobie. My family lives in St. Paul. I'm a home care worker. I am testifying on the behalf of my union, SCIU Home Care, Minnesota and Iowa. We represent over 55,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. I want to thank you for two important parts of the bill. First, your omnibus fund funds the minimum wage rule from the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board. The rule provides an industry-wide minimum wage of $19 an hour in 2026 and 2050 and the year after. There are higher minimum wages for CNAs, TMAs, and LPNs. You can have complete confidence that the money will go to workers and will help ensure care for our seniors. Second, you fund the tentative contract agreement for SCIU home care workers and four home care programs, including PCA Choice, the CFSS budget model, the CDCS program, and the consumer support grant. Currently, I work full-time as my son's caregiver. My son's name is William. He is 22 years old. William is nonverbal and was diagnosed with autism and cognitive delays at the age of three. William requires 24 hours support, and he needs assistance when he uses the bathroom, when grooming, bathing, dressing, and eating. He may never be able to live on his own or understand the empowering sense of freedom, choice, individuality, and independence. The same individuality, independence, and freedom of choice that you and I might take for granted every day. There are so many Minnesotans like my son, and they all depend heavily on the support of their home care worker to be able to do many of the things we take for granted. This contract gives me some hope for a retirement plan. It does not immediately put any money into a retirement plan, but it sets up the infrastructure for some employer-funded individual accounts. I hope in our next contract we can bargain over some kind of contribution. Funding for these programs has always received strong bipartisan support, and we hope to work with you and all members to contribute to that tradition. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Danny Eckert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. First, MHA fully recognizes the difficult and very strict budget constraints impacting the decisions that this committee has had to make in putting the DE together. Going forward, we urge the committee to continue supporting the recommendations and ongoing work of the Priority Admissions Task Force. I want to thank Representative Frederick for continuing to bring all stakeholders together to bring forward the best recommendations possible this year. To that, we strongly support the exception of adding up to 10 civilly committed community hospital patients to the waitlist for priority admissions to DCT. This exception will better serve civilly committed patients and will also free up more community hospital services and resources for all Minnesotans across the state. Additionally, and this is very important, ongoing and dedicated funding for capital investment and workforce to increase capacity at DCT is imperative. Therefore, we urge this committee and members of this committee to support House File 2587, which is authored by Representative Frederick, and its proposed bonding-supported expansion of Anoka Regional Treatment Center. That bill was heard in capital investment yesterday. Further, MHA supports proposed changes to the MIN choices reassessment in Article 2, Section 14 of the DE. MHA also supports additional provisions expanding who can be a MIN choices assessor, process improvements, and also timelines. Those provisions are not currently in the DE, but we appreciate that conversations are ongoing, and we urge this committee to support those provisions. Lastly, MHA supports the extension of funding for and the grant timeline for supported decision making. That's in Article 2, Section 56. Supported decision making is needed as an available and viable alternative to guardianship, especially when guardianship is not needed. That process also protects the scarce and very limited guardianship resources across Minnesota for those who do need it. And then in closing, we look forward to continue working with this committee and the tough decisions you have to make and key stakeholders to advance the recommendations of the Priority Admissions Task Force and making sure that Minnesotans have the best available care to them when and where they need it. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Chair Noor, Schogmacher, and members of the committee, my name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of diverse child and family serving organizations. Across our child and family service continuum, there is a consensus. We must address the crisis in access to children's mental health care. We know that with the reassuring presence of treatment that our families and children do better. They build skills, see progress, and experience hope. This matters in our schools, communities, and for our futures. Unfortunately, too many of our babies are currently boarding in hospital EDs, in juvenile detention, and with counties because of our crisis and access to care throughout the system. We are grateful to this committee for your review of the DHS outpatient Medicaid rate study. Fixing our rates is foundational to solving the crisis, and you all thoughtfully engaged in that early conversation with Representatives Bierman and Baker. We thank you for that priority conversation and know that that bill is traveling separately. In this omnibus, we are grateful for your embrace of solutions to children boarding and investing in the PRTF working group to improve our current benefit and meet more child and family need, and the work to increase access to MIN choices assessments through increasing who can serve as an assessor, clarifying process timelines, and strengthening accountabilities. We also appreciate your solutions that address the SchoolLink Behavioral Health Grant funding cliff. This beloved model integrates mental health care and equips school culture to better support all students while delivering valuable early intervention. We appreciate the creation of flexibilities and respite flu solutions for children with disabilities and strengthening safe harbor responses. We know too many of our children are falling through the cracks with boarding, experiencing crisis, and being exploited. As we seek to improve care, we must also assure there is safe harbor. We have the solutions for our children's mental health crisis. We are grateful for the ways in which this omnibus contributes to those solutions and look forward to working with you to support the well-being of children and families as we have much more work to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll go to Zoom, Ms. Schneider, and then we'll go to Sherry Park, who's with us here. In the meantime, we have Lisa Lane and Nancy Cashman, if they can move to the testify table.
Good morning, Chairman Noor, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Schneider. I am the chair for the Minnesota Board on Aging, and I'm here on behalf of House File 1472. I want to thank the primary author of that House file, Representative Womani Hilsley, and also the co-sponsors, Chair Noor and Representative Vernon. I spoke with you on March 18th about our request for some additional funding to help along the Senior Linkage Line, our free statewide service that helps individuals find the resources and the supports they need. I told you at that time that we're abandoning about 150 calls a day, and we are needing a little bit of help so that we can continue to be the premier service in Minnesota. Since I spoke with you on March 18th, some things have happened, obviously. At the federal level, the recent upheaval in the Department of Health and Human Services has made the need for coordinated leadership so that we can continue to provide this full range of aging policy and leadership in Minnesota. We're going to need the help more than ever because of those concerns at the federal level in a time of disruption and confusion. So I've come back today again to thank you for your interest and your support, and to tell you our needs haven't changed and they have become even more urgent. You'll be hearing in a moment from Sherry Pugh, who is chair of the Age Friendly Council, the Minnesota Board on Aging, Senior Linkage Line, the Age Friendly work, and the coordinated efforts that we do through productive partnership, I think are giving us good value in the state of Minnesota. And we hope to be able to continue with the benefits of unity that we have experienced over the years. Thank you very much, Chair Knorr. I appreciate your time and the effort that your committee is making in these somewhat troubling times.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Ms. Pugh. So welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Knorr and Chair Schumacher and committee members. One of my favorite professors at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Myers, always says, "What is the problem?" If you've had his class, you've heard that before. And the problem is that Minnesota is aging. We are aging faster than we've realized we would by this time. We're over 1 million people over the age of 55, more people over age of 55 than there are children under the age of 18 in our state. It's not a problem, it's an opportunity. I'm here today to introduce and reinforce the important work of Age Friendly Minnesota Council. As communities manage demographic shifts, embrace for a season of disruption and change, now is the time to initiate more change, but to bolster proven plans by advancing shared work across the state for older Minnesotans. The Age Friendly Council of Minnesota has built an incredible momentum since our inception in 2019, 1 month before the COVID shutdown. We are well established and active at work with our 15 council members and our 4 staff. The council is made up of 9 state agencies, 6 governor appointed community members from around Minnesota. The council work needs to continue uninterrupted. We need to ensure funding now to continue our work. I'm going to briefly talk about 2 major pieces of work that we do. The multi-sector blueprint. First, over the past several years, the council has been working on Minnesota's first multi-sector blueprint on aging. This plan is the culmination of aging priorities across multiple sectors in every region of the state. Minnesota is leading this effort nationally, and the goal of the blueprint is to align aging efforts related to healthy aging, transportation, housing, caregiving, support, just to name a few of the topics in this comprehensive plan. Grants is our second major area of emphasis. Our second round of grants to states, state agencies and nonprofits exceeded 100 applicants who are funding things throughout the state. I'm sorry, I lost my speech in front of me. But anyway, we wanted to give the example of Aiken County, which is the fastest growing aging county in the state, where 40% of the residents are aging. We gave them a grant that allowed them to do renovations to make accessibility to one of their community facilities that is patronized by the seniors and aging community in that state, I mean in that county. So with that, I just want to once again ask for your support and continue our efforts in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pugh, for your testimony. Next is Lisa Lane. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Knorr and Schumacher and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Lane, and I represent Open Arms of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 2434 Omnibus Bill. Special thank you to the chairs for including senior nutrition and HIV support services in the Omnibus Bill. For almost 40 years, Open Arms has been preparing and delivering medically tailored meals to vulnerable, sick, and food insecure Minnesotans. We have witnessed firsthand the role that proper nutrition plays in the health outcomes of both critically ill seniors and individuals living with HIV/AIDS due to complex illnesses that often require highly customized and restricted diets. These individuals cannot simply access traditional food shelves where the sodium in one can of soup is more than they should consume in one full week. Their diets are highly regulated and customized. 80% of our senior clients are living with food insecurity and critical illness. All of them depend on Open Arms because they are too sick to shop or cook for themselves. One third of our senior clients come on our service already at risk for malnourishment, and over 77% of them improve or stabilize while on our service. But current funding is not enough to serve all seniors in need. This week, Open Arms has 100 clients on waiting lists, and we've had to turn away another 150 clients in just the last month due to funding cuts. These are food insecure, low income, often homebound, malnourished older Minnesotans. The story is similar for those living with HIV/AIDS. Access to proper nutrition is not merely a convenience, but a medical necessity, helping their medicines work most effectively and decreasing their risk of malnutrition. Without success of this bill and the additional funds supporting medically tailored meals, 240 of our HIV/AIDS clients will surely face significantly worse health outcomes, increased hospitalization, and diminished quality of life. Investing in senior nutrition and HIV support services as part of House File 2434 Omnibus Bill helps reduce hospital visits and nursing home admissions. Senior nutrition
and please wrap up.
HIV services can be the difference between living independently or needing more. On behalf of the clients of Open Arms, thank you for your support.
Thank you so much. We have a testifier online, Mr. Nelson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Knorr, my name is John Nelson, the Executive Director of Residential Services Incorporated. I'm going to change my testimony to save time, so I won't repeat what you've all heard about concerns with the disability services cuts, except to say that I wholeheartedly agree with the concerns you've heard about the impact of the proposed cuts, from the proposals to cap inflationary adjustments to DWRS to remove the absence and utilization factor, the county share of rate exceptions, and the licensing fee increases. All of these things are going to have a disastrous effect, and I share Josh Berg's frustration and fear that these proposals have really failed people with disabilities. I want to use my time just to emphasize a point I don't think you've heard enough about today, and that is that these cuts may save money in the short term, but I know and I can guarantee you that they are going to cost more money in the future. Disability waiver services provide so many of the most important social determinant of health care, helping people find friends, helping people get to preventative care, helping people get jobs, finding places to live that they're happy with. These are the things that keep them out of hospitals, keep them out of emergency rooms, keep them out of jail, reduce 911 calls. All the things that we're worried about are going to be happening and end up costing more. And I hope that you will consider the kind of the short-sightedness of these proposals and the impact they're going to have. I, like Josh, stand ready to help propose more sustainable ideas to address the cuts or the deficit in the future, and I hope you will take us up on that offer and please not proceed with the type of cuts you've proposed today. Thank you, chairs.
Thank you so much. Ms. Sue Abdeholden, Reverend Goldthwaite, and also Frank Jedwin, if you can get ready for testifying. Please introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Cashman, and proceed.
Thanks. Good morning, Chairs Knorr and Schumacher and committee members. My name is Nancy Cashman. I'm the executive director at Center City Housing. I'm here to talk about the revocation of the supplemental service rate, so I'm really grateful to hear that it's going to change, but I do it might help to have a little sense of how we're using that. We have over 1,000 units in Duluth, St. Cloud, Bemidji, Invergrove Heights, and Rochester, most of which are supportive housing for high-barrier homeless people, including youth and children. We house and provide comprehensive services to 284 people right now in six buildings across Minnesota that are living in our supportive housing units with the supplemental rate. Additionally, I have two units that are currently under construction that were awarded funding from Minnesota Housing partly because I provided proof that the funds would be available for the next 20 years and the future of that, and that losing those, if that changes significantly, I don't know how I will be able to even open those properties. Everybody we house in these properties are considered very, very high barrier homeless, because they have very little housing success in their adult life. Many people have lived 1 to 5 years consecutively on the streets of Minnesota prior to entry. Many others have been precariously housed over and over, going from housing to the streets to emergency shelter and circling around and around. When this housing support supplemental service rate was initially legislated, it was because there was a recognition that the level of support needed to succeed at long-term housing success with people with this level of disability was really needed. And this obviously has not changed over the last 15, 18 years, as you know, costs have increased. If my understanding is correct on the way the initial legislation is written, if the wording and the change to this right now, if it goes as it's stated, most of the six programs that I have would not be funded because they don't fit into the other initial language. So my biggest concern is how revoking these funds will have the effect on 344 previously homeless people who may end up back on the streets because we can no longer provide the housing that's needed. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abdeholden, Executive Director of NAWI Minnesota. And I want to thank Chairs, both of you, for your hard work in putting together this omnibus bill. As you know, we are in the midst of a mental health crisis, and your committee was not given a great target. So we do appreciate the investments you were able to make, but honestly wish it had been more. We appreciate the investment in school-linked mental health. It is an amazing program. We call it the best thing since sliced bread. We eliminate barriers for children to access care, and we need to keep that program going and funding. We appreciate being able to use one-time crisis funding so that the crisis teams can purchase protected transport vehicles. Since we are having trouble with police carrying out transport holds and bringing people to the hospital, this will provide an alternative and keep people out of jail. After years of advocating for greater oversight over sober homes or recovery residents, we were pleased to see the language in the bill that would do just that. My only suggestion would be to change line 119.6 to refer directly to Mental Health Christ County Mental Health Crisis Teams and 988, just so that that's clear. Also, throughout this section, it refers to mental health conditions, but in the Adult Mental Health Act, we actually refer to mental illnesses. And because of the high rate of co-occurring mental illnesses and substance use disorders, we believe that someone from the mental health community should actually be on that working group. We appreciate the creation of the PRTF working group and the DCT LOC PRTF group as well. Men Choices needs to change. I just talked to a parent this week whose young adult has very severe psychosis, and they're still waiting 6 months to get a Men Choices assessment, and that's just unacceptable when they need that level of care. A couple of things that we had concerns with, including changing the name of mental health practitioner to behavioral health practitioner. Many in the mental health community, especially NAMI, do not like the use of the term behavioral. These aren't behaviors to be changed, but symptoms to be treated. No one goes around saying, I have a behavioral health condition. They say they have a mental illness or a substance use disorder. We really wished you could have funded the third path for children. We have worked so hard to separate the children's mental health system from the child protection system. We have to stop making parents go through the child protection door to obtain residential treatment for their children. Lastly, we truly need a bonding bill with a larger target in order to fund a new 50-bed facility at AMRTC so we can address the number of people with mental illnesses languishing in our jails and, frankly, our emergency rooms and hospital beds as well. Again, we wish you had been able to make greater investments in our mental health system to better meet the needs, the increasing needs of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and members of the committee. My name is Reverend Emily Goldthwaite, and I'm the Director of Congregational Organizing at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. I appreciate your hard work this committee has undergone to create this bill in these difficult budget realities. I'm here to speak on resources for supportive housing. At Beacon, after our congregations provided emergency shelter to families in their houses of worship for over 30 years, we committed to creating permanent affordable homes with on-site services to help families thrive in areas like employment, mental health, parenting, and education. This year, 90 families moved into their new homes in Hopkins and Minneapolis, and more are in development in Shakopee and Maplewood. We know that supportive housing is the solution to homelessness and invite the state to partner with providers like Beacon to not only build these homes, but to fund the services that will make this model work specifically for families. So I thank the committee for hearing and considering our proposal with Representative Ryer, House File 1644, which addresses this gap. This bill would have been a powerful intervention in generational homelessness. We know you faced really difficult choices in this year's budget. We remain hopeful that since it was included in the Senate's bill, we might continue to work together to prioritize families who are rebuilding their lives after homelessness. I just want to briefly draw attention as well to the concern about repealing items around housing support in Section 8 of the bill. Housing support is a key funding source for housing and services, specifically for individuals who live in supportive housing. And I understand your desire to repeal individual service rates to organizations, and thank you for the increase to the supplemental service rate. However, by repealing Subdivision 1G, you remove the authorization for all supportive housing to use housing support. And we think that was probably unintentional as a consequence, and it would be devastating for supportive housing to not be able to use housing support. So please work to restore 1G in the final version of the bill. Thank you again for your work to invest in the stability and success of families in Minnesota.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Jadwin. I'm the program manager for the Collaborative Care Model Services at Hennepin Healthcare. And thank you for the opportunity to share my testimony today. I'm here to urge you to include making the collaborative care model a Medicaid benefit in the budget proposal. Minnesota faces gaps in access to mental health care and substance use treatment, and making the collaborative care model a Medicaid benefit is a crucial evidence-based step towards addressing our state's growing mental health and substance use crisis. The collaborative care model is a proven, innovative care model with efficacy demonstrated in around 100 randomized clinical controlled trials to be an effective intervention across diverse diagnoses, patient populations, and treatment settings. It is a team-based approach integrating behavioral health services into primary care settings, decreasing total costs of care by 13% by means of reduced ED and hospital use. Instead of referring patients to external specialists, primary care providers collaborate directly with mental health professionals on their own team. This enables timely treatment and allows coordinated care for both physical and behavioral health conditions. Research shows that this approach is about twice as effective as usual care, which is why Medicaid plans in 37 other states have already made the decision to include the collaborative care model as a covered Medicaid benefit. Straightforwardly, it is efficient and effective care. This model has shown significant success in improving patient outcomes, reducing healthcare costs, increasing provider satisfaction, and increasing the overall quality of patients' care. It also delivers care more efficiently, allowing people experiencing mild to moderate mental health and substance use challenges to be treated in primary care settings, and reserving specialty care for more complex or severe presentations that would benefit from more process-oriented work or those needing a higher level of care. I urge the committee to include making the collaborative care model a Medicaid benefit in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll now move to the Zoom, but before I do that, we have 30 minutes and almost 19 individuals. If you are going to join us via Zoom at the end, we may shift that, thanks to Chair Schumacher, at the beginning of tomorrow. So we will allow those who are here to testify, and via Zoom we may be able to shift you for tomorrow. Before I call Tom Gillespie, I do have other individuals who are here. Jeannie Pellin and also Paul Verretti and Darren Simonson, if you can come to the testifier table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairs. My name is Tom Gillespie, President and CEO at Living Well Disability Services. We're a nonprofit based on the east side of the metro, serving about 300 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And I join you today to express my really sincere disappointment in the provisions that are before you today, but most specifically the removal of the absence and utilization factor. I know that you've heard about this several times already this morning, and I know from the initial comments that this is not a final draft, more of a direction, but I have to share my extreme concern and that of my peers with this direction. We saw it come from the governor. We see it perpetuated here. What you're proposing, what you're doing with that removal, along with future caps, is you're raising the cost to provide services. So every provider will pay more. You are also taking money off of the table. It's about a 4.5% reduction that you're assigning to providers. So you're increasing our cost. You're taking 4.5%. For my organization, that's $500,000, and we're losing money and have for the last number of years while we wait, frankly, for your funding to catch up. And on top of that, you're gutting the future of our services. You're suffocating our ability to stay current in a market that we're already not current in. By your own math, we're behind and we're underfunded in our wages and in the cost of doing business. So please, we beg you to reconsider these areas. Again, you're raising our costs, you're taking money off the table, and you're tying our hands in the future. Please do better, and please let us help you do better. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. I'm Paul Verrett, Public Policy Director, Agate Housing and Services. We recognize that this is a difficult year and that you must make very difficult decisions to meet the state's budget goals. However, I'm here with serious questions about the DE1 HF2434. We are pleased to see that there is a $1 million increase in the emergency services program. It is good to know that you are aware of the importance of this program, but this increase is not enough to meet the growing statewide need for shelters with 24-hour, 7 days a week services. Inadequate investment in street outreach and shelter is a life or death matter statewide. Shelter quite literally saves lives. And while shelter capital has $3 million allocated to it in the bill, it is also not adequate. Next, I'd like to talk to you about important changes in this bill to the housing supports benefit. We currently support at Agate more than 700 households receiving permanent supportive housing using it. The vast majority are qualified as having experienced long-term homelessness and all have disabilities. I was happy to hear Chair Noor's remarks that the intent of this bill is not to get rid of the supplementary service rate, and I look forward to seeing the additional bill language. As it stands, the repealer represents a significant threat to a system that is responsible for helping people to receive the services needed to make a permanent end to homelessness. Without these services, we face the choice of depleting reserves for those who have them or not providing services. Neither situation is tenable. If something is not done to change this, recent gains in ending homelessness could be quickly reversed. Shelter and supportive housing are always less expensive and more effective than a reliance on emergency services that is often associated with rises in unsheltered homelessness. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Chair Schumacher and committee members. My name is Ginny Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Our association is a member association representing 38 community mental health programs, mental health centers, and certified community behavioral health clinics across the state. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today on your omnibus budget bill. We appreciate this opportunity. I'd like to say thank you for the committee's understanding and response to our state's mental health and substance use disorder service crisis, especially under this difficult budget target that you all have. Specifically, we're very grateful for the inclusion of the children's targeted case management inclusion up to ages 21, the addition of behavioral health practitioners in the 245G Medicaid programs, the inclusion of school-linked behavioral health funding grants, crisis funding for our mobile crisis response teams, the increase to our substance use disorder rates in our Medicaid system, and in particular, funding to address our direct care and treatment capacity for children and adults under the current 48-hour law, while the review panel members and community stakeholders are looking to find solutions on how to apply this funding to. We all know that more is needed to do in this mental health space while we continue to build out the continuum of care for our SUD and mental health services. And we thank you for the good work in helping us to continue building the system. And we look forward to partnering with you as we continue the great work. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Don Simonson. I am president and CEO of Trellis and a co-chair of the statewide Senior Meals and Services Coalition, including Open Arms. You just heard Lisa Lane's testimony a few moments ago. Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, and bill author, Representative Fisher, and members, thank you for including a biennial appropriation for senior meals in your recommendations for the Human Services Omnibus Bill. We are grateful for your support. Today I speak on behalf of Area Agencies on Aging, or AAAs, and our longstanding community partners across the state that deliver meals to low-income seniors experiencing health and cognitive challenges. My Greater Minnesota counterpart, who I think you heard from last week, Jason Swanson from the Mankato area, was not available today, but he also sends his thank you and gratitude for the committee's support. Together, AAAs and our statewide partners support older adults trying their very best to live at home with chronic conditions or following an acute health incident such as a stroke or a broken hip. Many do not drive, they live alone and have difficulty shopping and preparing healthy food. The funding for meals included in your recommendation will reduce the risk of malnutrition among these older adults and has the added value of reducing isolation. These funds will also help to reduce wait lists, service reductions, and site closures. This is a win for everyone, including the state and its taxpayers. Senior meals are an upstream services. They're essential. They support older adults to age at home where they prefer to live and help to delay or avoid Medicaid-funded institutional care. Thank you again for including funding for meals as part of Minnesota's strategy to care for older adults.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll go to now to Sean Burke, but I also wanted to ask John Torbett and also Mike Beltoski to come to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Sean Burke with O'Connell Consulting, testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities. CCD members are self-advocates, disability provider organizations, legal and other advocacy organizations working to improve the lives of people with disabilities. We share many of the concerns already raised by disability providers and advocates in written and oral testimony. For the sake of time, I want to highlight two specific areas of caution and areas where guardrail language is needed if certain cuts are to remain in this bill. The 6633 county cost share of rate exceptions may lead to unfair and unequal cuts depending on where a person lives in our state. Rate exceptions have been a critical tool in addressing the unique and complex needs of individuals with disabilities, and the current centralized system of rate exceptions ensures fairness. Over a decade ago, the state had to defend litigation over a similar county cost share tool in other parts of our waiver system. So going back to the county share tool is tempting in times of tight budgets, but it could have the effect of exacerbating regional and geographic disparities. So if this cost share remains in the bill, we strongly recommend guardrails to ensure that counties are fairly assessing all requests for rate exceptions and that they're not rationing care based on the fear of increasing costs. There is additional DHS oversight that could be added to this language. We look forward to working on several different suggestions. The other issue are changes to the CADI and BI eligibility. That's Article 2, Sections 1 through 3 and 15. These are significant changes to eligibility, and they will affect access for those on these waivers. Changing the nursing facility care eligibility cannot be done lightly. To the extent this provision does move forward, we strongly encourage two amendments. First, amendment to apply it only to new waiver applicants. Otherwise, existing waiver recipients are likely to lose their waivers. We also suggest an amendment to add due process protections that would, at a minimum, give specific directions to lead agencies to explain why someone is being cut, extend the amount of time that someone has to appeal, and list all possible other service options that an individual may have. We, of course, recognize the difficult decisions that have to be made this session. We appreciate that this is the start of the process and look forward to collaboration. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you to Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is John Trivett. I'm a service area director at Avivo in the Ending Homelessness Division. I'm here representing Avivo at large, but in particular the Ending Homelessness Division, and frankly, in collaboration with a lot of the other community members that are working on ending homelessness throughout the state of Minnesota, and in particular looking at the housing support supplemental rate. We appreciate deeply the fact that there's a recognition that this tool of housing support can be used broadly and in many creative ways to help confront the opioid epidemic, the mental health crisis, and homelessness in general and throughout the state, and that there's a need to create equity throughout the state in that process. And I also appreciate what my colleagues have said. I'll try to really hone in on some key points. As the statute appears to be amended, under 1G, it also, that provision allows for scattered site LTH and site-based LTH long-term homeless programs to be in existence. And so, for example, at Avivo, there are 300 individuals that are in that scattered site program that are allowed that supplemental rate. 78% of those are Native Americans. At Avivo and a lot of our community providers, we're really trying to lean into where the disparities are the highest. In addition, without specific articulation of the other subdivisions that have been repealed representing specific organizations, there is a risk that they will not be included within that additional enhanced or the additional dollars in the supplemental rate. And so just wanted to flag that as a point of concern to make sure that those are there. All of these are critical in our community facilities throughout the Twin Cities and the state need these dollars. Facilities like Avivo Village also need these supplemental rate dollars in order to continue to really address the need at hand. Thank you so much, and we appreciate, we know you've got an earful yesterday with this, so thank you for hanging in there and doing all the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. In the meantime, I would like to ask Sarah Kaufman, Marcus Schmidt, and Gina Evans to come close to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mike Baltowski, Vice President of Program Development for Horowitz Health and the Treasurer of March. In my role, I've worked with nearly 70 counties and more than 2,000 patients across Minnesota this past year, giving me extensive insight into the Behavioral Health Fund process. I'm here today to address concerns regarding Section 34 and the shift of Behavioral Health Fund eligibility from a 12-month window to 60-day consecutive period, changing the eligibility period from 12 months to just 60 consecutive days is both problematic and unrealistic. Providers diligently assist clients in transitioning to medical assistance and subsequent prepaid medical assistance plans, yet this process can take months, much more than 60 days, even when performed flawlessly. Reducing eligibility to a mere 60 days unnecessarily restricts access to critical life-saving services for some of Minnesota's most vulnerable individuals who often experience non-linear recovery journeys, eliminating access to funding that is very limited in scope to critical substance use disorder services. While we strongly support the stewardship of public funds, it must not come at the expense of essential patient care. I do hope we can work collaboratively to refine the system to ensure it remains responsive, efficient, and capable of providing essential behavioral health services to Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is Marcus Schmidt. I'm the executive director at Hearth Connection. Our mission at Hearth Connection is to strengthen Minnesota's supportive housing community to advance long-term solutions to homelessness. Moreover, right now we're deeply committed to protecting state resources during a period of a lot of uncertainty. Echo the concerns shared by many of my peers that were expressed this morning regarding the current language's repeal of supplemental services in nearly all supportive housing settings. This would be a devastating blow to service providers. We know it would shut down programs and lead to an explosion of homelessness across the state of Minnesota. We do appreciate the commitment to addressing the language to avoid these unintended consequences. Toward that end, I thought it would be helpful to provide some real quick context to these rate exceptions. Historically, when providers wanted an exception to the supplemental service rate moratorium, they would have language go in two places in Chapter 256I, first into 256I.04, Subdivision 3, to give them an exception to the moratorium generally so that they would get that service rate. Second into 256I.05 to get a higher rate. Then over time, legislative staff preferred to consolidate and have both of them, both moratorium exception and rates, be in one place in 256I.05. That resulted in some of those subdivisions for higher rates, and then some are just for the standard rates. So subdivisions 1D through 1U are repealed under 256I.05. The only way they can still keep that standard rate at the end of the day is if they're also named under 256I.04, subdivision 3. So I agree this is way more confusing than it needs to be. And appreciate that there's attention to this, and we're really looking forward to working with the committee to update that language in the weeks ahead. And just want to thank you all for your public service and for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor, Schumacher, and members of the committee. I am Sarah Kerfman, President and CEO of the Down Syndrome Association of Minnesota, which represents the nearly 4,000 people with Down syndrome in Minnesota. I am also mom to a child with Down syndrome. I also want to say I've worked for more than two decades in finance and operational consulting and understand the steep climb ahead of you, and that cuts, while painful in any one place, need to be made. I'm here to talk about the cumulative effect of all those cuts on the disability community. In 1985, the average life expectancy of a person with Down syndrome was just 29 years old. Now it is more than 60. So what has happened in the last four decades to affect that change? Sure, there's medical advances, but to put it in perspective, your life expectancy and my life expectancy has only changed 4.3 years. So what really happened between or right before 1985 and today? It's community inclusion. In 1975, IDEA was passed, allowing children with disabilities to access school. In 1980, through all the way until 2004, institutions were closed, allowing people with disabilities to live in community. And in 1990, the ADA was passed. Less than 2 years ago, we celebrated the historic legislation that was passed in Minnesota, improving the lives of people with disabilities and improving community inclusion for those people. I don't have to, nor do I actually have the expertise of the gentleman next to me or Sarah Grafstrom that spoke from ARM to go into the detail of each of these cuts. And I understand standing alone, any of those might be a painful but reasonable proposed solution. It's the collective effects of the cut that are most painful to not only the providers, not only the counties as they have to raise property taxes, but at the end of the day, to the parents. And so I'll end with the last kind of piece in this bill that is probably most alarming. At 675% of federal poverty level, it seems like a reasonable place to reintroduce parental fees for TEFRA. I do want to stand here and say that there are many people in this committee who helped pass getting rid of those fees less than 2 years ago. And while 675% of federal poverty seems very high, just know that someone working at minimum wage for a full year is already at 200% of poverty level. And I think we all agree that it's very hard to live on a minimum wage here in Minnesota. So $217,000 a year is the federal poverty, 675% of federal poverty level for a family of four. That's basically two working parents. And so the 4.75 starting place of parental fees going all the way up to north of 7% equates to mainly just a tax on people who have disabilities. And so I'll end with that. And thank you. I know this is a hard hill to climb, but again, the collective and cumulative effects of all the cuts together undo years and years of progress for our community.
Thank you for your testimony. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Noor and Schumacher and members of the committee, my name is Gina Evans, and I serve as an advocate at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today, and I don't envy you the difficult decisions that this committee has to make. I'm here to share the very real and serious consequences that would result from eliminating enhanced rate funding for that serve the most vulnerable Minnesotans struggling with substance use disorder. At our organization, this funding is a lifeline. It allows us to serve over 400 men and women on any given day living with chronic substance use disorder and very high acuity who often have no other options for care and funding. Without enhanced rate funding, we would not be able to provide the level of treatment that is both essential and life-saving for our patients. This funding enables us to deliver a full continuum of care that includes 24/7 on-site nursing services to address complex medical needs, life skills training, coaching and mentorship, life planning and vocational training support, family services that foster healing, education, and reunification for parents, comprehensive relapse prevention and aftercare planning. These aren't extras, they're the foundation of the program, and for the people we serve, there are no other residential funding options. This was the case for me. After 15 years of IV meth use, five other treatment programs, three trips to prison, and a lifetime of trauma that I learned how to cope and cover with drugs, alcohol, and criminal activity, I was at the end of myself and at the end of the resources that were available to me in the state. I spent 15 years digging a hole to the bottom, and I needed long-term care and long-term solutions to find my way out. Without this support, access to care for people like me disappears. At a time when street drugs are more potent, more addictive, and more available than ever, eliminating this funding would be devastating, not just for the individuals we serve, but for their families and communities. I urge you to protect enhanced rate funding and continue standing with thousands of the most vulnerable Minnesotans in reclaiming their life from addiction. Thank you for your time and commitment. And again, I don't envy you the job you guys have to do, and thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. We'll now go back to Zoom. We've got Emily Moore. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi. Thank you all for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Emily Moe, and I have worked in Borden Lodge and LTH, or long-term homeless housing, combined now for over 25 years. I apologize. I won't be quite as eloquent as the others before me, and I don't have any stats. I just have my many years of experience working in the field. I'd like to ask the chair for clarity on the elimination of the housing support supplemental services, or if it's just targeting the enhanced rate. Will this new language then address only the enhanced rate? And if so, please understand that this will still be a detriment to many, if not all, the Borden Lodges or the other programs that utilize this enhanced rate. I was also asked to speak for multiple Borden Lodges locally here who will be forced to close their doors and forced to unhouse and put many disabled individuals back out onto the streets. Please understand who lives in these settings. These are individuals who are incapable of living independently without these services. This is literally the only housing option for so many. We house people of our community struggling with mental health symptoms, developmental disabilities, substance abuse issues, or many other barriers that prevent them from living on their own. These are not individuals who would choose to live in these settings. These are people where this is their only option other than the streets. We work with individuals who have barriers that range from, again, mental health, substance abuse, developmental disabilities, but also individuals who have criminal histories, individuals who are unable to be housed due to their criminal background.
Ms. Moy, if you can wrap up your testimony, please.
Perfect. Again, this would be closing the doors of multiple programs, even cutting the enhanced rate. They're already struggling to be able to provide these services for their individuals. This would then put so many individuals back on the streets. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The last person via Zoom is Chakwana McIntyre. She's no longer there. We have one person who signed up late. We'll give you a minute to testify. And public testimony will be closed. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name is Melanie Emery, and thank you, everybody, for for formality purposes, I want to say thank you to everybody really quickly. And I represent a boarding and lodging facility that offers specialty services. It's located in Virginia, Minnesota. If you don't know where that is, it's about just under 3 hours from here and about an hour from Duluth. So it's Iron Range territory. And really, I couldn't have said anything more eloquently than what about the last couple speakers, because a lot of people are kind of speaking about different things with this bill. One thing that they did not bring up, because most of it was basically covered, was just the health and safety factor for those of us who use the supplemental services for not only the residents but also our staff, because we also provide medication passing services, and a lot of those medications are a controlled substance. So if you can imagine putting that in a scenario that was just described by Teen Challenge and then Emily, who was just speaking, it's a safety concern if you're just allowing them to kind of have their own medications, because they can either give those to other residents or just misuse them themselves. And so I just really encourage the language to be, I guess, thoughtful and also be considerate about that. And one question I guess I had was, it sounded like the supplemental rate was going to be increasing the standard rate. Does anyone know what that amount exactly is? Is it going to become closer, I guess, to bridge the gap from the enhanced rate to standard rate? Because we have essentially some of our beds that are considered enhanced rates and then some of ours that are standard, but we offer the exact same services. So we're essentially losing money every year by offering the same services. So if that's eliminated, then we're kind of asked to triple our losses already that we're incurring.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members, public testimony is now closed. You also have written testimony in your package for your review. Mr. Chair and members, we do have a $1.3 billion biennium challenge that we're going to address. It's not easy. Our goal is not to target programs or services. Our goal is to make sure that we can be able to provide services to the most vulnerable individuals, individuals with disabilities, our seniors, and the promise is for us to continue to work on this bill. With that, I think the amendments are due tomorrow, I believe. I don't want to send you the next day. By 5 p.m., we want to make sure that all the amendments are in, and that is the deadline that we're setting. And, Mr. Chair, any closing remarks for tomorrow's walkthrough?
Just amendments.
We look forward to the amendments, and we will have we will not have public testimony, but members' discussion tomorrow. With that, we are now adjourned.